This is an Ecodharma audio recording of a series of three talks from Buddhafield's Green Earth Awakening event in July 2014. The series is called Connect, Empower, Liberate, and it's delivered by me, Gujupati, a member of the Ecodharma Collective. For more about our work, check out www.ecodharma.com. So, this is part of the third in a series of three talks, Connect, Empower, Liberate. And 2 days ago I was talking about connection, yesterday I was talking about empowerment, and today I'm going to be exploring the theme Liberate. So, there's a place to start, and so you don't have to wait until later on in the talk wondering. I want to let you know at the beginning what I understand as liberation in terms of the three linked dimensions of connection and empowerment that I've been talking about in the previous two talks. Those three dimensions are the personal, the social, and the ecological. So the essence of personal liberation is really well captured for me in the phrase by Dilgo Khyentse, that when we recognize the empty nature, the energy to benefit others dawns, effortless and uncontrived. I think there's a real elegance to that. It weaves together both shunyata and pratityasamutpada, both emptiness and conditioned arising. It kind of honours the timeless heart of liberation and yet situates it right here, right now, in our actions in the world. The bottom line definition I'm using for social liberation is very simply establishing the conditions as widely as possible that support people to flourish. The conditions that support that include factors like economic and social justice, a social balance of cooperation and autonomy, a basis for empowered participation in social process and decision making, and the opportunities in society for people to live meaningful and useful lives. And out of that, of course, there are opportunities for individuals to grow into the fullness of flourishing that Dilgo Khyentse's phrase points towards. So neither personal or social liberation can be separated out from ecological liberation. That's a fantasy. As my friend John Curtin put it, what we do in the environment, what we do to each other, and what we do to ourselves are all interlinked. Healthy individuals grow in healthy societies, and healthy societies grow in healthy relationship with the environment. But still, what do I mean by ecological liberation? Well, in terms of the ecological, liberation simply means refusing the human conceit that we are somehow above and separate to nature, or that we have dominion over it. It means resisting actions that arise out of that arrogance and creating ways of living that heal us from it. It would be ridiculous, I think, a ridiculous conceit to think that nature somehow needs us to liberate it. It is and always will be wild, with integral value in itself. We just need to honour that and stop treating it as merely something for human exploitation. So unpacking some of that as I go along. But I finished the talk yesterday leaving the theme of equanimity hanging in the air, and today I think that's a good place to start. I've already said that the development of individuals and the development of our communities, our societies, are bound together, and that social and ecological engagement are actually a vital basis for personal development, and that personal development of the qualities that arise through Dharma practice strongly empower social agency. So equanimity is one such quality, and it's a quality closely connected with the Buddhist view of liberation. So studying the words of engaged Buddhists over recent years, it appears that many agree that one of the most useful contributions Buddhism has to offer social action is the quality of equanimity. And yet, it seems to me, misunderstood, equanimity poses one of the greatest obstacles Buddhism can put in the way of social engagement. So if you've done your Buddhism 101, you'll know that traditionally equanimity plays an important part in the Buddhist Dharma. So not only is it a quality we develop to support our ongoing practice, but in some formulations of the path, it occupies a position almost synonymous with the liberation often depicted as the goal of Buddhist training. It suggests a deep imperturbability, like the depths of the ocean, maintains a profound calm, even as the waves on its surface swell and crash tumultuously. But the traditional texts also slap some important health warnings on equanimity. Loud and clear, they caution, do not mistake equanimity for indifference. Indifference, they say, is the near enemy of equanimity. Indifference might suggest some close similarities to equanimity. But as all good foragers know, it's all too easy to pick something with a passing resemblance to a tasty and nourishing species, but that is in fact a poison. The mistaken identity is a common error, but an indifferent, detached withdrawal and lack of connection with the world is not the equanimity the Dharma points us towards. It's a toxic pretender, a near enemy. But even so, it does offer an alluring surrogate. So the challenges of our times with its economic and ecological irrationalities, social tensions and precarities all too easily tip the balance in us towards tendencies to withdraw. It's no wonder that disconnection entices us, and all the more so when mistaking indifference for equanimity, we can use Buddhism to provide the rationalization that rather than copping out, we're actually gaining spiritual maturity. Turning towards the near enemy of equanimity is actually very widespread. It's not only Buddhists who are seduced by the coping mechanism of withdrawal. Donald Rothberg lists a range of contemporary forms of indifference, the kind of state of the art of equanimity's near enemies. He lists them as denial, complacency, resignation, acquiescence, numbness, intellectual aloofness, rationalization, cynicism, dogmatism, fear of strong emotions, particularly anger. Sound familiar? We've probably all heard sort of smug reassurances that the planet won't actually be destroyed, or life will go on, only humanity will be wiped out, and that perhaps we deserve it anyway. But how contorted must we become to feel reassured by abstractions that fall back on a mineral baseline, that make irrelevant millions of years of evolving biodiversity and the actual scale of suffering a major die-off event implies? How often do we hear views that accommodate our predicament, which present themselves as grounded in maturity and wisdom, when in fact they're merely ways of suppressing the heart? Denial is one of the defining psychological constellations of our times. It plays out all around us all day long, becoming increasingly integral to our lives and our socio-economic system. Denial underpins the passionless mainstream discourse, which allows a statistical analysis but gives no room for heartfelt response. It fuels growth economies as we consume to avoid discomfort. Denial is good for business in the short term. And shielded by unacknowledged privilege, denial leads to a terrible life-withering complacency and superficiality. Indifference, compounding denial, is a grave danger. And yet, despite the perils of misidentification, equanimity still remains one of the most valuable qualities Buddhism can offer us in meeting the challenges of our times. In its authentic forms, it offers a source of fearless compassion and incisive wisdom. So how can we learn to know its true character and not ingest its toxic lookalikes? Well, yesterday I was saying that the cultivation of equanimity sits within a fourfold practice, the practice of the four immeasurables or the Brahma-Viharas. There are, like I mentioned yesterday, three other qualities that are required to support the development of equanimity: metta, karuna and mudita. So training in equanimity actually begins with metta, or loving kindness, fostering a caring, intimate connection with the pulse of life in ourselves and in others, the human and the non-human. And when this intimate caring turns to face the suffering in the world, it meets that quite naturally as karuna or compassion. And when we turn that intimate caring of metta to meet the happiness and well-being of others, it unfolds as mudita, a sympathetic, joyful appreciation. And I was pointing out yesterday that these three qualities of metta, karuna, mudita, they augment each other. Metta offers the starting point of gently opening the heart. Compassion, turning that openness towards suffering, protects metta from degrading into sentimentality, stirs us into action. And the appreciative joy of mudita keeps us alive to the potential for freedom and flourishing in the world, provides us with nourishment, feeds our efforts to alleviate suffering. So training to cultivate all three of these qualities is the groundwork which protects the development of equanimity from collapsing into its surrogate, life-denying near enemies. They ensure that our path towards liberation is not escapism dressed up in spiritual garb. Unless our equanimity grows out of caring intimacy, deeply alive to the pulse of life, unless it holds within it a passionate and committed engagement with the suffering of the world, unless it's illuminated by joyful appreciation, it's not the equanimity the Dharma points to. Rather than aloof detachment, equanimity is more like the capacity that the Gitano flamenco tradition celebrates when it claims that our capacity to experience joy is only equal to our capacity to stay open to suffering. Equanimity is a deepening capability to stay open to the way things are, in all their heights and their depths. And as equanimity grows, our capacity for compassion and joy also grow. The deep calm of the ocean does not diminish the rise and fall of the waves on its surface. It adds a depth of context, but it doesn't turn away. Damaging as they are, we can't just cast off denial or indifference and that constellated range of heart-closing tendencies. They serve us in a way. The near enemies of equanimity are also, in a sense, our near friends. It's been said that humankind can only bear so much reality. So opening up to the way things are can be overwhelming. And our psyche applies strategies which protect us from that crushing power. So useful in opening up beyond those self-protecting strategies, it can only happen little by little. So what's so deeply valuable about an integrated training in the four immeasurables is that not only does it protect equanimity from the surrogate forms of denial, but the training actually provides the range of emotional skills that we require to tend with care and with patience to the gradual process of growing beyond those self-protecting strategies, to recognize the fear and the grief that lie beneath them and to nourish our heart and enable us to move gradually towards a more empowered and a more fearless commitment in the world. So in this sense, equanimity brings together connection, empowerment and liberation. With the right training in equanimity, it really is a quality that can deeply empower our efforts to meet suffering and injustice in the world with a transforming and liberating action. So these are especially difficult times to engage in action for social and ecological justice, for social and ecological liberation. When social change has never been a simple thing. It's complex. In a sense, it can be quite mysterious. So Lawrence Cox, who's a member of the Tree Ratna community in Dublin, recently drew my attention to a passage by William Morris, which he wrote in 1886 in A Dream of John Bell. And he says, "I pondered all these things and how people fight and lose the battle. And the thing that they fought for comes about in spite of their defeat. And when it comes, turns out not to be what they meant. And other people have to fight for what they meant under another name." Social change is very rarely a story of simply winning or losing. There are times when movements are defeated, but the changes that they fought for happen anyway. And there are times when a struggle is won, but the outcomes are not what we had hoped for. There are compromises and mistakes and movement betrayals that all add complexity to our relationship with our struggles and the process of social change. But the stakes feel so high at this point, so hypercharged today. I mean, in recent years, I've seen many engaged people despair and fall into despondency, to give it up. We live in really uncertain times. We face challenges of an unprecedented scale. And to meet that, we need a training that roots our motivation more deeply than we've ever known before. We need a vision and a practice that will sustain compassionate action beyond both hope and hopelessness. So several years back, there were a group of us rebuilding an old farmhouse in the Catalan Pyrenees. It went on to become the main accommodation for the courses that we're running at the Eco Dharma Centre. We spent about 6 months through the winter building with traditional techniques, limestone, big sort of pine trunks for the main joists and the floors, using raw wool to insulate the roofs underneath salvaged terracotta tiles. And halfway through the work, we downed tools and we set off on a long journey across Europe to Copenhagen. It was the year of the COP15, which is the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. And there were delegates heading there from all over the world to explore, you know, globally coordinated efforts to tackle climate change. The political optimists were dubbing the meeting Hopenhagen. So COP15, it was a magnet for campaigners, NGO campaigners, grassroots activists. You know, the scientific consensus had again underscored the evidence. Rising carbon emissions are leading to serious devastation of Earth's biodiversity and human suffering on a vast scale. And not taken in by the Copenhagen feel-good hype, amongst the grassroots, the rhetoric in the air was that this is our last chance. Some long-term climate activists scoffed. For them, the maths was already clear. It was already too late as far as they were concerned. But for many others, it felt like it was still worth one last-ditch effort to avert climate chaos. So amidst that Scandinavian winter, the delegates argued, campaigners lobbied, activists held meetings, as they do, and mobilised all sorts of, you know, very creative actions, aiming to pressure global leaders to do something worthwhile, or to inspire people to take matters into their own hands and to sidestep the political circus in a sort of more popular struggle for climate justice. The Danish police response was unapologetically, if predictably, harsh, repressive and illegal. And the grassroots were battered. The outcome of the conference itself was the announcement amidst self-congratulatory fanfares that the representatives had agreed to talk some more at some point in the future. 5 years later, they're still talking. So, the last chance passed us by. No meaningful coordinated effort was agreed on. Economic growth continued to trump ecological security. Amidst the sense that it was now or never for the planet, we missed the now. So presumably it was never. The last ditch had been overrun. As people dispersed, and bruised and exhausted, there were tears and anger and disillusionment. And soon enough, the theme of climate chaos dropped back in the mainstream discourse to kind of phantasmagorically drift in and out of popular consciousness. And in the following years, the levels of burnout amongst environmental activists soared. The anecdotes tell of action groups falling apart, generalised dismay and despondency, even increased suicide attempts. The zeitgeist of the moment is captured by Frederick Jameson's phrase, "It's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism." So since then, there's been a lot said about the counterproductivity of the politics of catastrophe, how it fosters a self-righteous and sacrificial radicalism. It breeds cynicism and hopelessness. It drives public awareness into deepening ruts of psychological denial. And generally, it strengthens the hand of reactionary social tendencies, both hedonistic evasions and fear-induced right-wing populism. So consequently, many environmental activists are looking for new stories to tell, you know, stories that can inspire vision, confidence and action for a life-affirming future. We hear that we need not wait for government to act before we can begin to build resilience into our lives, and that our collective efforts to do that will nourish our need for community and renew our spirits. The new land-based projects for sustainability spring up. Fresh and creative approaches to mobilising are in the air. New economics, gross happiness indexes and permaculture are all reclaiming life-affirming design for the future. The Occupy movement, Emma Kinzer, climate camps, they've all been reshaping inspired politics of creative optimism. I mean, these all provide really priceless context for people to flourish, to realise their values and collective efforts to benefit the world. And clearly, as far as motivational psychology goes, it's an advance. It's all learning that needs to be celebrated and welcomed. And yet I still feel that there's a place for caution. All too easily, the continuity of our efforts can be trashed by the swing from the energised uplift of hope into the seemingly inevitable downturn of hopelessness. A motivational economy raised on a bubble will burst, just as surely as a market raised on subprime mortgages will crash. Powerful social movements are slow to arise, and their causes are complex, at times even mysterious. But when they do arise, they arise out of a continuity of effort. It's just as with personal change. We need to maintain a gentle and persistent heat to bring the crucible to the right temperature, to catalyse deep transformation. Too hot and it burns. But if we keep taking it out of the fire, we never reach that melting point. To support an ongoing engagement with the necessary longevity for movement building, we require a motivating vision that can fully embrace the uncertainties of our times. An inspired vision that's not propped up by merely hopeful optimism, but retains its power and its value, whether we succeed or fail. They're complex times. We can't know if our present actions will succeed in bringing forth new ways of living that honour our rootedness in the ecological, or whether indeed we stand amidst currents whose flow towards a calamitous end times is just too strong to turn. Two images come to mind. A midwife tending to the birthing of new life, and a hospice nurse tending to the passing of the terminally ill. In our actions at this time, we can't know if we're midwives of a life-affirming future or whether we're nursing the dying process of a terminally ill civilization. Perhaps it's both. What really fascinates me is that whether midwife or hospice nurse, both call on the same life-affirming qualities of care and compassion, both witnessing the first breath of a newborn child and the last outbreath of a dying parent, can both be met with wonder and deep appreciation of life. The value of life is not lessened by the fact of death. At times it's even heightened by it. So I want to be clear, I'm not trying to validate a Dharma-inspired approach that confirms Nietzsche's statements in The Antichrist that I quoted a few days ago, that Buddhism is a religion for the end and fatigue of a civilization. Nietzsche seems to have seen Buddhism as a way of accommodating ourselves to a resigned and melancholic fatalism. That's not what I'm pointing to. What I'm pointing to is the empowering attitude of the Bodhisattva, the Buddhist compassionate warrior who trains to perfect an unwavering, vigorous effort, an energetic action grounded in compassion amidst both birth and death. And that energetic engagement is what is known as virya. Importantly, however, virya only matures into an unwavering compassionate engagement because it's perfected in balance with kshanti. Kshanti is a profound patience, a radical receptivity to the way things are. Virya and kshanti together combine to dynamize effort with a resolute energy that's more like the steady turning of the sun and the moon, not the mere motivational bubble of optimism. The motivation of that depth is what can support an ongoing engagement with the necessary longevity for the complex process of movement building, fully embracing the uncertainties of our times. As I said, it provides an inspired vision of what's possible that's not propped up by hopeful optimism, but that retains its power and value whether we succeed or fail. But I think it's useful to interrogate in ourselves, how do we understand success and failure? What do they mean to us? So responding to the challenges of our time requires three kinds of action. Firstly, we require actions that resist further ongoing degradation and damage to ecosystems and society. But in addition to stopping more damage, we need actions which create alternatives in economics, social relations, alternative ways of producing. And as well as resistance in creating alternatives, we also need actions which enable a shift in the world views and the values that have underpinned our historical trajectory to the current point of crisis. We require a shift in consciousness. And I discussed some of those new ways of seeing in the first talk, especially emphasizing the value of connection. So working for a transition from the industrial growth society to an ecological and socially just future, it requires us to ensure that our efforts don't reproduce the old world views that got us here in the first place. As Aung San Suu Kyi once said, without a revolution of the spirit, the forces that produced the iniquities of the old order will continue to be operative. So if we want our social action to be congruent with the shift in consciousness needed for a real transition, we need to bring awareness to how the views we carry shape our social action, shape our social aims, our political objectives, and our strategizing. How we understand success and failure sets our vision, and our vision shapes our strategies, and our strategies will shape the actions we take to fulfill the objectives, which are the stepping stones along our strategic pathways. One of the most important clusters of views we've inherited from the old order that often carried over into the visioning of our socio-political work are views about time. In his work, The Decline of the West, Oswald Spengler says, "It is by the meaning that it intuitively attaches to time that one culture is differentiated from another." The way we relate to time plays a key role in shaping our world. Time is so fundamental, the assumptions are so basic, that we often take time to be a given characteristic of reality. But different cultures and different traditions give different meanings to time. They understand its structure differently, and consequently they live in different worlds, and they interact with those worlds in different ways. At the heart of the dominant Western worldview, which has underpinned our historical development, the development of the industrial growth society, there's an approach to time which prioritizes linearity. Our socio-economic structures, political ideologies, our ways of living are all influenced by assumptions about that basic fabric of temporality. They suggest it has directionality, that we're heading somewhere, and that that somewhere is somehow usually better. The dominance of the idea that time is primarily linear can be traced back to the influence of millenarian Christianity, with its vision of history heading towards a salvational or damnational endpoint. This religious myth of salvation has been repeatedly reproduced in secular political myths. It's apparent in the Marxist view of history and other utopian revolutionary traditions, and also in ideological neoliberalism, leading to the now embarrassing claim of the end of history that accompanied the fall of the Berlin Wall. So one of the dangers of these grand historical narratives is the way they enable the justification of means by reference to some idealized end. As Frederick Jameson again pointed out, it was Marx's view of the communist utopian end of history that provided the step from Hegel's teleological and idealistic philosophy to the Gulag. And we can see the same tendencies played out again in the missionary rhetoric of globalizing freedom and democracy used to justify the invasion of Iraq. And even where salvationist views of politics are tempered, a deep faith in progress still predominates. The liberal humanist view may reject the idea that we're heading towards a predetermined endpoint. Realist humanism scoffs at the naivety of such utopian idealism, but it still champions the history of humanity as fundamentally one of progress. The core assumptions underpinning our growth-based industrial development have been that growth will go on, technology will advance, things will get better, that increasing production, more consumption, rising population are all monuments for humanity's ingenuity and our wedded destiny with progress. So some of us are beginning to recognise that these assumptions are part of the hallucinatory self-image that shaped modernity, a deluding and conceited fantasy. The story is crashing against the non-negotiability of ecological limits. Its threadbare weave is being torn apart by mounting social tensions. The myth of more and more is becoming shipwrecked on the rocks of simply not enough. And yet how much do these deep views, ideas like the myth of progress, still underpin our political and social struggles and strategies? Have we really woken up from that dream? How much do we still invest in our work for social change as a project of salvation? To what extent, seeking the new, do we continue to reproduce the old spirit? So many older and indigenous traditions ground themselves in a different view of time. For them, time is cyclical. Rather than the modernist obsession with the ever-unfolding newness, time shaped more in terms of repetitions and returns, re-emphasising the cyclical, the passing and the returning of the seasons, the waxing and the waning of the moon, the passages of growing, dying and the regrowing of things. These are approaches that root us here and in our basic ecological identity, a basic ecological identity that salvational programs, both religious and political, seek to deny. It's not that pre-modern people are unaware of the linear dimension of time. You know, there's no doubt that a nomadic tribesperson begins to erect a shelter with a sense that as she takes those steps, you know, putting poles up, adding canvas, so on, that linear progression of steps won't result in an erected shelter. And yet, those accumulative linear steps of construction, they take place within an awareness of the non-progressive aspects of life, with an acknowledgement that one day, what has been built will be dismantled or destroyed. It says a simple Buddhist refrain points out, the end of hoarding is dispersion. The end of building is destruction. The end of meeting is parting. The end of life is death. But this reminder of impermanence shouldn't be taken to imply a fatalistic or nihilistic endpoint either. Death in turn becomes the basis for life, as the darkly composted forest floor reveals. But what does it mean for our political and social projects if there are no mundane achievements which resist the transience of things? If time is not assuredly ticking towards historical salvation, what is politics for? Some years ago, I was trying to promote an awareness and action within the Triratna Buddhist community addressing climate change. And I remember one practitioner correcting my misguided efforts by pointing out that we cannot fix samsara, the round of existence characterized by impermanence and suffering. At the time, and I think rightly so, I regarded the comment as a rationalization of disengagement, justifying a kind of Buddhist quietism. But now, I think it's crucial to integrate that idea with passionate engagement with actions for healing our world. It's important that we don't invest in our socio-political action salvational expectations they cannot deliver. And yet, unless we want to retreat into a life-denying escapism to arrive at the developmental dead end that Miles Horton called getting stuck on the inside, we do need to attend to the social, material and ecological conditions of life. Our political and social action might not offer a basis for some ultimate salvation, but they do create conditions which reduce and alleviate suffering, that even can support our flourishing, at least temporarily, sometimes for generations, and in terms of ecological impacts, perhaps for many generations. Social political action can and does have value, but we have to be wary of oversubscribing power to a social action that they don't have. We need to take care not to grasp after permanence in what is not permanent. And if we can give up the conceited notion that there are permanent solutions to human suffering and that somehow we are destined to get there, we can begin to fashion ways of living that integrate the incredible ingenuity of humankind with a deep humility. We can stop arrogantly overreaching ourselves in projects which pit an inflated human will against reality, that seek to repress mortality, that vainly deny the limits we live within. And we can apply our creativity to living with a renewed maturity. As well as helping us to shape socio-political vision, the shift towards both honouring human potential and finding within ourselves a renewed and deep humility supports ecological liberation. As I said earlier, ecological liberation simply means refusing the human conceit that we're somehow above and separate to nature, or that we have dominion over it. It means resisting actions that arise out of human arrogance and creating ways of living that heal us from it. It would be ridiculous to think that nature needs us to liberate it. I remember taking a long walk a few years ago, turning over in my heart, my mind, another drop of information about the ecological destruction being caused by our social trajectory. And at one point I sat on an outcrop on the high ridge of the Cerro Corallo, which runs east-west above the Ecodharma Centre. And as I looked out over the majesty of that landscape, I felt that mix of pain and numbness that such reflections give rise to. But as I was sitting there, a pair of alpine choughs arrived. They swooped into view. They were playing and diving like choughs do. They're such agile, such intelligent birds. And there was something in their play that transformed my experience. They broke me out for a moment from my anthropocentric anxieties. They revealed a quality in nature that's not reducible to our human concerns. They reminded me that in a sense nature is and always will be wild, that it has an integral value in itself, irreducible to our ways of understanding the world. Nature needs nothing from us. In a sense, it's complete in itself in ways that we can scarcely imagine, although we can feel the resonance of that. Plum blossom needs no liberation, nor is it on a path to liberation. Liberation really is only a human concern. It's only us that need to resolve our struggle with freedom. But part of our liberation requires us to honour the integral value of nature beyond our own views about what it is, and ensure that our personal actions protect nature from our own delusive ways of living. To ensure that our socio-economic systems are transformed to honour the integral value in nature, to stop reducing it to something for our exploitation. There's something about reality that is always wild, and we need to discover ways of living that are not at odds with wildness, to stop vainly asserting our petty views and our ways on reality through deluded action. Ecological liberation demands that we make a shift away from anthropocentrism, a human-centred conviction that we're special or fundamentally different from nature. It encourages us to decentralise the world from us, to shift the gravitational centre of meaning away from ourself and to redistribute it. It asks us to step into a world where reality no longer revolves around our belief and understanding, but which also takes account of the diversity, the fecundity, and the irreducibility of the wild. So this kind of decentralizing of the world, it challenges us at two levels, both emotionally and cognitively. Emotionally, it challenges us in terms of desire. It asks us to open up to the way that the world does not conform to how we want it to be, and that perhaps it never will. Cognitively, it challenges us in terms of our views. It demands we begin to recognise that the world is not reducible to the way we think it is, and that it never will be. So this shift away from the anthropocentric asks us to acknowledge that we and nature are not separate, and in terms of action, asks us to act in basic solidarity with all of life. And perhaps we can begin to get a sense of what the rainforest activist John Seed is getting at when he says that he doesn't experience himself as someone trying to save the rainforest. He experiences himself as that part of the rainforest most recently emerged into consciousness, protecting itself. There's something integral to liberation in Buddhist terms that's about letting go. Many key teachings concerning liberation in Buddhism emphasize that. The Heart Sutra says, "So know that the Bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in pranya wisdom, is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana." As Dilgo Khyentse's statement reminds us, true letting go does not lead to a quietistic endpoint when we recognise the empty nature, the energy to benefit others dawns effortless and uncontrived, he says. It's through this profound letting go that truly creative and compassionate action arises. But letting go is not easy, and it rarely happens all at once. It tends to be incremental. We kind of edge forwards a bit and then we pull back again. And we need the right conditions to support the confidence to really let go, to support what in Buddhist terms is called Shraddha. So this is a really simple scheme, which from sort of the world of experiential education, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, but I think it's very useful to kind of look at this in terms of, you know, our personal development and also in terms of social transformation. Right? So this is, the basic idea is very simple, that, you know, this middle circle here represents what's called the comfort zone. So when we're in our comfort zone, we're like, we're chilled, you know, we feel very safe, very comfortable, everything's kind of easy, everything's known to us, right? But it can also sometimes be quite stagnating. This middle area here is called the learning zone. And on the outside, we've got this other line, and you can see beyond that line is the panic zone. So this line just outside the learning zone, right, before we reach the panic zone, you can sort of say that that's the line where if we go beyond that, we no longer feel safe. In the learning zone, we're outside of our comfort zone, but we're not yet at a point of panic. You know, we feel safe enough. We're resourced to meet the challenges, to be opening up, to be changing, right? To be learning new. As soon as we go into the panic zone, we close down. Our learning stops again. You know, that's why on the courses we do at EcoDharma, we do a lot of work with sort of building a good kind of group process where people feel safe and held and cared for so that they can step into, you know, take the risks of stepping into this learning zone. So flourishing as human animals, it involves us being in conditions that enable us to find the nourishment of the comfort zone, whilst also being supported to step into the learning zone again and again. That's how we evolve, that's how we develop. And some of those conditions are internal, to do with our emotional capacity, for example, but others are external to us. Buddhist practice can really help us to set up the internal conditions to keep stepping into the learning zone, to help to expand the learning zone. You know, the more we move into the learning zone, the sort of our comfort zone starts to grow, and this edge of the panic zone also gets pushed further out. It's constantly shifting, developmental process. So Buddhism can help us to sort of, you know, find the confidence to keep stepping into that space. But social conditions also play an important role. So before concluding the talk, I'm going to touch back into the social dimension of liberation and how the social is a necessary condition for really letting go. As I said, although supportive social conditions might be temporary, we do need to create them as a support for human flourishing. So it's very easy to see what happens to us amidst conditions of social insecurity. All too often they throw us into the panic zone. You know, economic uncertainty, the precarity of employment, insecure housing, atomized communities, they all play into the hands of closing us down. So it's a recognizable social phenomena that social insecurity breeds fear, and commonly the fear-based politics of right-wing populism, nationalistic self-interest, xenophobia and racism. It's as if the clubbing together against a phantasmagoric threat offers a surrogate sense of unity to replace the real sense of connection that's integral to human well-being. So the globalization of late capitalist neoliberalism has especially added to these experiences of precarity in society today. They've corroded the values of community and civil society, often leading to a withdrawal from public life. Consumerism has replaced meaningful participation in shaping our shared social sphere. And we've seen an increased withdrawal from political activity. So there's a classic reference written by Robert Putnam, his survey called Bowling Alone, which amongst other data, it grasps the drop-off of membership in most voluntary associations in America during the neoliberal period. And in his, there's an excellent book written by a man called Tim Jackson called Prosperity Without Growth. In that he says, more generally, Western society appears to be in a grip of a social recession. And there's surprising agreement on this from across the political spectrum, he says. For example, Jonathan Rutherford, a commentator from the political left, points to rising rates of anxiety and clinical depression. increased alcoholism and binge drinking and a decline of morale at work, while Jess Norman from the political right highlights the breakdown of community, a loss of trust across society and rising political apathy. So that's Tim Jackson. And those are views that are backed up by research. Where neoliberalism has been most vigorously pursued in Europe, namely the United Kingdom, the European Social Survey shows a significantly greater breakdown in trust than in countries that have pursued neoliberal policy less vigorously. There's an author of a Sheffield University study of community who claims that even the weakest communities of 1971 were stronger than any community now. So, of course, most of that, you know, it's great, eh? Quoting sociologists and everything, but most of that we can testify to in our own experience. And it's likely that it wouldn't come as a surprise to many Buddhists. You know, the Dharma points out that human nature is conditioned. It says we are capable of both selfishness and altruism. And in fact, both of those capabilities play a crucial adaptive evolutionary function in our survival. So Tim Jackson again, he points out, each society strikes the balance between altruism and selfishness, and also between novelty and tradition, in different places. And where this balance is struck depends crucially on social structure. When technologies, infrastructures, institutions, and social norms reward self-enhancement and novelty, then selfish, sensation-seeking behaviours prevail over more considered or altruistic ones. And where social structures favour altruism and tradition, self-transcending behaviours are rewarded and selfish behaviour may even be penalised. So basic economic justice and security, as well as empowering social settings, you know, supporting a sense of connection and community, are needed to create the conditions for people to thrive, to support people to develop, to be nourished, to be able to step into the learning zone in their lives. We need those supportive settings. And creating those conditions, that's what, you know, social engagement is all about. But to engage at this point, to engage socially at this point, there's a big step we need to take. In a way, it's important for us to actually reclaim a sense of that possibility that we can change things, that our agency can have an effect. There's a book actually by Mark Fisher called Capitalist Realism. He says in that, for most people under 20 in Europe and North America, the lack of alternatives to capitalism is no longer even an issue. Capitalism seamlessly occupies the horizon of the thinkable. We're left as spectators, Fisher says, on the sidelines, enduring what he calls a reflexive impotence. So the demise of an alternative vision and the potency of social agency was, you know, I mentioned earlier that phrase by Jameson, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. So it's important to recognise that whilst we can't determine the outcomes of our actions, there is something necessary in reclaiming a sense of the possibility of social agency. We can actually often forget that important achievements have been made by earlier social movements. We often take a lot of them for granted. It used to be weekends, 8-hour days, you know. Stuff that, again, is starting to get eroded again now, you know. A welfare state, national health systems, all these things were won by struggles, concerted, coordinated struggles of people just like us. We take them for granted, and sometimes we lose sight of those achievements. They get co-opted and they get claimed by political power as their achievements. So it's important to recollect how far we've come and how many times we have actually won, how much we've inherited from social movements in the past. So this is another quote from Lawrence I mentioned from Dublin. that he passed on to me recently. This is from Ken McLeod. Ken McLeod says, "Hey, this is Europe. We took it from nobody. We won it from the bare soil that the ice left. The bones of our ancestors and the stones of their works are everywhere. Our liberties were won in wars and revolutions so terrible that we do not fear our governors. They fear us. Our children giggle and eat ice cream in the palaces of past rulers. We snap our fingers at kings. We laugh at popes. When we have built up tyrants, we have brought them down. Change does happen. It has happened. And it is happening as people come together in all kinds of collective efforts today. There's a real growing movement for social and ecological justice. And connecting with that movement, connecting with each other, we can empower each other to support more change. We don't know what the outcome will be. But connecting and empowering each other, opening up to the possibilities of liberation, are also ways of truly flourishing in and of themselves. And for me, they're integral to a meaningful Dharma practice in our time. So when we talk about Buddhism, we can often forget that it's not monolithic, that in fact it's a tradition of incredible richness and variety. Throughout its history, it's adapted to all sorts of cultural settings. Buddhism has continually evolved and reshaped itself. Its forms have mutated and changed to keep its basic truths and methodologies responsive to the different needs in different places and cultures. So the Baroque feudality of Buddhism in Tibet, the austerity and the simple aesthetic of Chan Buddhism, the contrasting formality of institutional Theravada and the shamanic aura of the forest renunciate, they all reveal the creativity of the tradition. But as well as blossoming with relevance and usefulness, Buddhism has also at times withered into reactionary and stifling forms, such as the ethnic bigotry of some Sinhalese Buddhism, or the warmongering of Japanese Zen in the 1940s. So again today we see Buddhism changing its shape, applying its heart teachings to our times. And a few decades ago, it might have made some sense to talk about Western Buddhism. But what does that mean in an age of globalization? In recent years, in most of the countries where Buddhism is newly arising, or taking root, globalization has meant the globalization of late capitalism. And there's a danger that contemporary Buddhism, adapting itself to be relevant to the specific historical conditions of our times, actually becomes not a Western Buddhism, but a late capitalist Buddhism. Rather than Buddhism bringing its radically transformative energy to meet this late capitalist world as a force for much needed change, it could be so easily that Buddhism is actually degenerated by the power of contemporary socio-economic forces. It could so easily be that Buddhism actually becomes colonized by the influence of late capitalist society. The Dharma is not immune to the co-opting power of capitalism, which has so far shown itself to be undoubtedly the most dynamic and potent socio-economic formation in human history. We'd be naive to believe that our approach to Dharma practice is insulated by from the influence of our education and our socialization within that system. The ubiquitous sway of neoliberalism and consumerism, emphasizing individualistic and narcissistic preoccupations, powerfully shapes our interpretation of the world and almost inevitably colors our interpretation of Buddhism. So in Buddhist circles in recent years, there's been a lot of criticism of Slavoj Zizek's presentation of Western Buddhism, which he claims presents itself as the remedy against the stress of capitalism's dynamic. By allowing us to uncouple and retain some inner peace, it actually functions as the perfect ideological supplement to capitalism. So his critics have got a few things right. His take on Buddhism is sometimes superficial, and it suggests a rather limited familiarity with the tradition. Nevertheless, he does highlight a distinct danger. There are tendencies within Buddhist practice that can lead us into dead ends. And in a late capitalist world, these dangers are supercharged. There's a crucial question for Buddhists today. It's like the challenge that met the Catholic Church in Latin America in the 1960s. The social injustices of their situation ask the question, whose side are you on? And it was out of answering that question that liberation theology arose. And liberation theology went on to make really important contributions to civil society, contributing to a social landscape in which the recent shifts towards more socially progressive politics in South America could take place. So similarly, our times ask us, what side is the Dharma on? So I hope that in these talks I've made it clear where we position eco-dharma. We're bringing the Dharma into relationship with the aspects of contemporary culture that we can call an emerging ecological paradigm, and its approach that recognises that the connection, the empowerment and the liberation of individuals, of communities, of societies and the ecological are all necessarily interlinked. It's a vision that can help us to resist the social and ecological damage wrought by the late capitalist order. That can support us to create alternative ways of living that are in solidarity with life, with nature and with each other, and which can support us to truly flourish as human animals and to discover our deep potential for authentic liberation. There you go.